Some of you I know are Fawcett members and some of you are not. So I'll introduce myself first. I'm Annette Lawson, I'm chair of Fawcett. And I have just two really very nice duties to perform this evening. One is to tell you just a tiny bit about Fawcett, in case you don't know. And the other is to introduce our guest speaker, Joan Bakewell. First of all, just let me tell you what Fawcett is currently doing, but also just to tell you why, because some people may not know, we're actually called Fawcett. We're called after Millicent Garrett Fawcett, who was a great suffragist and one of those nine women who went to John Stuart Mill back in 1866 and said, "We need your help. We need to have a say in our futures." So we're named after her. She was the only one of those nine women who lived to be in the gallery of the House of Lords to watch the royal assent being granted to the bill in 1928 that gave us women, that is, the vote on equal terms with men. But while we're really very proud of our history, we're much more concerned to change the world that we're in now, much further, much more strongly, much more necessarily in the direction of equality between women and men. And the main thing we're focusing on, as you will all be aware, there's a general election looming. So we have a powerful general election campaign which is focused on a publication which has received a lot of publicity, you may have read about it, called The Gender Gap, which shows that women have been responsible for keeping a Tory government in power for 17 years because of the way that we vote, but also showing that while women over 35 tend to vote Tory, women under 35 tend to vote Conservative. Whichever way people vote, because of course Fawcett is not a party political organisation, but cross-party, whichever way women vote, what we're really concerned about is that women vote thinking about our interests as women, what it is that whatever candidate we have in front of us, what it is that she or he is going to do to change the continuing inequalities and oppressions that we live under. You'll find our publicity in the room where you were asked to go to buy a ticket, if you didn't have one already, just across the way, A86, and I hope that you will go and read it, pick up the literature, it's all for free. There's a lot that each one of us, man or woman, can do in the lead up to the general election. So that's what we're really focusing on. But tonight, we're focusing on one particular aspect of women's lives, women in the media. I don't think we could have anyone better than our guest speaker to tell us where we're at and where we've come from, because she's actually lived it. Those of us here who are old enough remember her back in the 60s with Meeting Point. We remember her brilliant work on the arts, as well as her work on religious issues, issues of faith, issues of philosophy, posing the major questions that worry us all about how to lead our lives. And I noticed that she gave her address at the end of her Who's Who entry as the heart of the matter, BBC. I'm sure that Joan is going to tell us what the heart of the matter is tonight. Joan Bakewell.
I'd just like to say that I'm obviously going to talk to you for some time, but as I go along, perhaps in the view that we, with a view to questions afterwards, you might like to think of issues you can raise and that we all might have a discussion. I'd rather enjoy that, because I need to be kept up to date, you know, with what's going on. I'm getting rather long in the tooth, and perhaps the youngsters here know more of what's going on than I do. However, let me tell you my story. However, first of all, let me begin by acknowledging the honour you do me in inviting me to give this 1996 Fawcett Lecture. Since 1886, I learned, the Fawcett Society has been campaigning for equality between men and women. And over 130 years, the emphasis of that campaign has shifted this way and that: education, the vote, wages and salaries. Its progress aided or hindered by forces way beyond its control: wars, economic cycles of boom and recession, developments in medicine, especially contraception. But there is no doubt the campaign's objectives have been and are being systematically advanced and achieved. I regard the improving position of women as the single most important social, political, and economic change of my lifetime. The story of women in radio and television covers, of course, a shorter time span. Before I turn to that subject, let me just speak for a moment of two remarkable sisters. You've already heard one of them mentioned, Millicent Garrett Fawcett, and her no less formidable sister, who you've probably also heard of, Elizabeth Garrett Anderson. They were born the two daughters of Newson Garrett, a builder, today we'd call him a property developer, in the little East Anglian town of Aldborough on the Suffolk coast. It was there that in 1946 the composer Benjamin Britten, along with Peter Pears and Eric Crozier, created the Aldborough Festival. And it's there that in June every year the world-famous Aldborough Festival takes place. Now, you will recall that earlier this year a proposal was put forward to erect a statue to Benjamin Britten, a proposal that came from a local council and was given a high-profile airing in the national press. Arguments raged to and fro, far and wide. And when, in the event, the Aldborough Council rejected the idea, allegations of Philistinism and parochialism were made. Now, I am myself a member of the Aldborough Foundation. That means I'm on the governing body of this institution. And I made no such allegation. What, after all, do you expect of a local council if it's not to be local, even parochial in its outlook? I was struck by another matter entirely. The two Garrett sisters, natives of Aldborough, unlike Benjamin Britten, an incomer from as far away as Lowestoft, 40 miles to the north, they have no tribute in stone, nor, as far as I'm aware, has any suggestion ever been made that one might be appropriate. I'm not sure whether public statuary can be called media. It certainly constitutes part of the environment that we assume honours those who are most deserving. Well, consider. Elizabeth Garrett Anderson was one of the first women doctors in Britain. The hospital bearing her name still offers health care by women for women. In 1908, she also became England's first ever woman mayor of Aldborough itself. Millicent Fawcett, her sister, as you've already heard, worked tirelessly with her husband Henry Fawcett to further the education of women and gain their political rights. Monuments to the famous are a legacy of a more robust Victorian civic pride than we feel today. They also get in the way of traffic and offer scope for vandals and for graffiti. Thus do the petty concerns and even squalor of life today govern matters of public honour and reputation. Well, memorials in stone or not, certainly Millicent Fawcett and Elizabeth Garrett Anderson deserve our tribute here today. I hope you'll bear with me for giving it to them now. Right, let me turn to women in media. I discern a tendency to think of the phenomenon as both recent and defined by growth, a sudden increase in the number of women with jobs in radio and television. An increase, it's also assumed, that took its impetus from the feminism of the 1970s. Tonight, I want to suggest that the presence of women in television and radio from the start has not been sufficiently recognised, virtually ignored, in fact. And thus, the development of their equality with men has been, and indeed remains, a far, far more gradual process than we might hope or have been led to imagine. Philip Larkin famously declared in his poem Annus Mirabilis, "Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me, between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP. It's true that, coincidentally, my own career as a professional broadcaster began in that momentous year, 1963. But women in broadcasting existed before then, as did sexual intercourse, of course, and both conditions had not become the focus of the self-conscious attention that they subsequently did. In the 1960s, both sex and women became the subject matter of the burgeoning pop culture. The falling away of the hypocrisy of the 1950s liberated the media itself to exploit, in both word and image, concepts of women and of sex that had previously found popular expression only in discreet romantic fiction, and highly charged but repressed British cinema. I'm speaking of the world of Rebecca and Brief Encounter. But from the start of broadcasting in the 1920s, women were a part of it, and important policy statements were made about them. The BBC's Written Archive Centre disclosed in 1985 much of this hidden history, and it's on that that I draw now. As early as 1926, John Reith declared, "I think we have been wrong in our attitude to the women on our staff in nearly all stations." By stations, he didn't mean station in life, he meant radio station. "They should be as eligible as men for promotion, and there is no reason why a woman should not be a station director." 2 years later, his direct assistant is on record as saying, "The principle of women working with equal status is accepted. The principle of married women working is equally accepted. Therefore, it is not only against public policy, it is also illogical to rule that motherhood entails discharge." While speaking up for women and declaring an intention of equal treatment, it is clear that both statements respond to a reality which is far from equal. The intentions may have been good. The reality was to get worse. In May 1932, the BBC instituted a policy of not employing married women. In response to the depression of the 1930s, the BBC felt that married women had husbands to support them and should not take jobs from single women who had to support themselves. By October of that year, it was clear marriage could lead to dismissal. Women's organisations protested in vain. In 1933, a memorandum went out to all women's staff. It said, "The retention on the staff of women who marry must not be taken for granted." According to the archive, the memo was drafted several times, the BBC clearly fearing reaction. They were right to do so. The memo leaked, of course, nothing's new. And the press attacked the BBC as behaving dictatorially. "Like Hitler," one of them said. And this is only 1933. It was all to no effect. Even when the economic situation in the country improved, that ban stayed. The familiar arguments were voiced. The work of a married woman would suffer due to her many home duties. The BBC, however, allowed that there were some women to whom the ban did not apply. Quote, "Charwomen and lavatory attendants," because, quote, "it was a normal custom for women of this class to have outside employment." Other women did, however, have the right to contest the ban before a tribunal, which then considered their appeal under 5 points. These are they: special value to the corporation, compassionate circumstances, long service and efficiency, career commitment, oh dear, that phrase, and most interestingly, character as bearing on the strain of combining married life with office work. The archive document from which I quote mentions one tribunal finding to give a flavour of the judgments they made. Quote, Miss Borden might be well advised to defer her marriage for 2 years. It takes the breath away. The ban persisted. In 1937, at the suggestion that it be relaxed, it was actually strengthened. It was decided that all women below grade C should automatically be dismissed on marriage without the right to appeal to the tribunal. War changes many things, and wars have always changed the position of women. During the war, the marriage bar lapsed, and in the post-war years, women were officially allowed maternity leave with their jobs held open. There was, of course, no such thing as maternity allowance, and the notion of paternity leave would simply have been thought laughable. But the legacy of attitude lingered on. When I first joined the BBC, as long ago as 1954, as a studio manager, it was made clear to me that husbands and wives were not allowed to work in the same department. I married in 1955 a radio drama producer, and my prospects within drama broadcasting closed then and forever. I often wonder what might have happened if my husband's career had not, of course, come first. That was the way it was. Nonetheless, and this is my main point tonight, despite the rigorous discouragement of the 1930s, talented women did, as you would expect, make outstanding careers in broadcasting. Perhaps because of what might be called the Philip Larkin dimension, they are rarely named and honoured. And in naming some of them here, I acknowledge that there are many others that I could name. Mary Adams joined BBC Radio in 1930. In 1936, she became the world's first woman television producer. Who's heard of her? There is no monument, no tribute.
One person.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I knew her, perhaps you did. By 1956, she was in top management as assistant to the controller of programmes. She held responsibility for public affairs, discussion, talks, many outside broadcasts, and women's programmes. Mary Somerville was director of schools broadcasting as far back as 1924. Marjorie Wace took over as director of morning talks in 1931. In that year, there had been the high-profile resignation of Hilda Matheson as head of talks. Now, the News Chronicle headline of the day read, A Woman's Duel with the BBC, 1931 we're talking of. And the story began, the struggle of a woman against a management of men lies behind the official announcement from the BBC. In the post-war years, women certainly found the situation easier. There were more key appointments. Doreen Stevens, head of women's programmes for BBC television. Mary Hill held the same position at Associated Rediffusion. Ursula Eason was assistant head of children's programmes. And beyond these women's interest spheres, there was Grace Wyndham Goldie, who had joined the BBC as a radio talks producer in 1944 and went on to become the moving spirit behind an entire spectrum of current affairs. She produced the first party politicals. Perhaps we could regret that. She conceived the electoral broadcasts of 1950, 1951, 1955, and 1959. She started the Tonight programme, a precursor of Nationwide. She invented Panorama, foreign correspondent, and the long-running arts program monitor. She was tenacious, resolute, and tough. She had to be. Joanna Spicer was another of that formidable breed. She joined the BBC in 1941, rising quickly to be a programme planner. By 1969, she was appointed assistant controller, television development. But there were clearly tensions. In her obituary in 1992, which was written by Leonard Mile, he remarked, "There was at the time no controller television development, that Spicer was only given the title assistant controller might be ascribed to a certain BBC male chauvinism in the 1960s. By 1956, a male journalist could write with patronising surprise, "Can you imagine a BBC in which many of the most important television and radio jobs are filled by women? Impossible? Not at all. The situation already exists. In round figures, the BBC staff consists of 8,600 men and 6,000 women, and there are several women heads of department." He might have added that there were women on screen too. Of the BBC's three first announcers, two were women, Sylvia Peters and Mary Malcolm. But women could be their own worst enemy. Mary Crozier, the then influential radio critic of the Manchester Guardian, wrote in the 50s, "The BBC gave up the idea of women announcers for the chief news bulletins a long time ago. Apparently the public feels something incongruous about them. I think I agree with the BBC. Women rarely sound so impersonal as men." So it was not the case that women had not been tried. They had been tried and found wanting by the public and the BBC. All that was about to change. The arrival of ITV in 1955 gave the staid world of the BBC a well-needed shock. It's hard now to imagine television, and indeed radio until then, as an entirely national monopoly. Without any commercial money or motive, no commercials on screen. Its objectives were unchallenged and shamelessly for the public good, quote, to educate and entertain and inform its audience. Once ITV was launched, there were plenty of jobs to be had with the independent companies all trying to put together groups of people with potential. Not many had more than potential because there was nowhere they could have acquired the broadcasting skills. These were days of optimism, of experiment and expansion. The first generations of scholarship school children were pouring from the universities, fired with enthusiasm and expecting and finding jobs, security, career opportunities. I rode in on that tide of optimism. I am a child of my time. I was born in 1933, only 5 years after women had got the vote. 3 years, indeed, after the death of Dame Millicent Fawcett. In the early 50s, I went to Cambridge, where there were only two colleges for women, and both the Union and the Footlights were closed to them. We accepted what we found. It was a strict, hierarchical, respectful society, and we were part of it. It's only an awareness of the constraints and the tight conventions of the 1950s that can explain the joy of the 1960s as those constraints and conventions fell away. Changes in television and radio were both cause and result of those new freedoms. Now, I'd like to step away from serious commentary for a moment and set in context, I do this unwillingly, but I feel I ought to face it out, an item of my own career of which I never speak and which I'm reluctant to perpetuate. However, it has perpetuated itself, and in so doing, it's thrown into clear relief the changes in media attitude to women. One of the ways of rejecting the old 1950s constraints and inhibitions was to speak more openly of sex. The pill was now a reality, and indeed, That famous 1963 decision in the Lady Chatterley trial made available to servants and wives the vocabulary of D.H. Lawrence's fictional lovemaking. You may remember that at the prosecution of the Lady Chatterley's lover, the prosecutor had asked witnesses, saying that, of course, it was perfectly all right for men to read this book, but did they want the book to be read by their, quote, wives and servants? Wives and servants were now allowed to read these words. Anyway, the parameters of decorous behaviour widened, and flirtation and wooing became a more acceptable social transaction. And against this background of easier talk and familiarity, a hapless journalist of the Radio Times was commissioned to write an article about Late Night Lineup. Now, Late Night Lineup was the daily late night talk show on BBC Two, of which I was a regular presenter for some 6 years. And the journalist inquired of Frank Muir, then a broadcaster of gallant and waspish humour, what he thought of us all. And Frank's remark, that he thought I was, quote, the thinking man's crumpet, dropped into the article as a casual familiarity. Unfortunately, this phrase has stuck to me like burr to wool. What broadcasters know as the cuttings, which is a heap of miscellaneous articles that accumulate from newsprint coverage of one's career, and over 30 years mine is quite a yellowing and dog-eared heap, the cuttings always refer to this particular phrase. It's there, it's always mentioned, I expect it to be in my obituary, and I'll be lucky if it's not on my tombstone. Each time I'm interviewed, and the BBC's publicity department is always pushing for profiles of its broadcasters, I ask that the phrase is not used. Women journalists often agree, trying sympathetically to resist what they recognise as a male stereotype. Too often they go away and ring back with apologies to say that an editor or sub-editor, usually male, insists that the phrase goes in. Sometimes they don't even ring back. What is of interest, only mild interest to anyone but me, is how the phrase has changed in significance over the decades. In the 60s, it was a teasing, cheeky, flirtatious remark. In the 70s, it changed. It was perceived by emerging feminists as downright demeaning, a chauvinist, sexist comment meant to define and thus control by flattery. I was even harangued at a feminist public meeting for not having publicly denounced its perpetrator. They were quite heavy those times. By the mid-80s, it might well have served as evidence in a case of sexual harassment. For since 1986, a court ruling established that sexual harassment was covered by the provision of the Sex Discrimination Act, which, as you know, came in 1976. In the 1980s, at last, the phrase has become dated. It's as fustian and outmoded as femme fatale or the it girl. Which isn't to say that a desperate journalist won't still dredge it up. They have recently from the depths of those mouldering cuttings. However, I offer the anecdotal history of this silly little phrase to reflect more significant matters concerning women in the media. By the 1970s, women were seriously present, both on the television screens and at radio microphones and behind in important areas of programme making. The 1970s was a time when organisations were set up. Women came together in seminars and conferences. The Equal Opportunities Commission began in 1975, and the mood of the times put informal pressure on men to appoint women. The arrival of first Angela Rippon at the BBC and then Anna Ford at ITV as mainstream newsreaders was a great breakthrough, not in jobs, not in equality of wages, but as icons to the entire society that the place of women in television could be the equal of that of men. Yet while women were coming together in awareness of the problems they faced, the absence of any existing official or even legal structures to back them up meant that they were often helpless or felt it was too risky to help each other. I'll give an example. In the 1970s, a senior BBC executive began to approach young women in his department one by one, with invitations either out for the evening or round to his flat for a meal. Individually, this was flattering enough and interesting attention, so many accepted. What happened then followed a pattern. Under pretext of some journalistic discussion or social concern, the conversation always came round to corporal punishment, and it was soon being suggested that the woman might submit herself to being smacked or beaten. Whether some did or not is their secret, but certainly a number made their excuses and left. But these were days when women talked to women. Stories began circulating. Soon it was felt, among the women themselves, that something should be done. The programme manager of the department was informed. He asked for proof. The BBC doctor was told. He asked for a dossier. The union was approached. They asked for written and signed testimonials. At the same time, as these things happen, stories began appearing in Private Eye. The BBC executive concern decided to sue. At this point, Private Eye's lawyers asked whether any of the women would go to court as witnesses. But such was their fear of incurring the disapproval of the BBC hierarchy and of threatening their jobs that only two out of some 20 women agreed. By now, the BBC's higher echelons were seriously concerned. Their fellow executive, the man in question, would be looking to them as character witnesses. So they asked one of the woman witnesses to bring forward what they called incontrovertible proof. In the event and at the 11th hour, a letter arrived from Australia bearing the testimony of an ex-BBC woman employee who had a similar experience. Almost immediately, and within a week of the case going to court, the executive dropped his case. He was removed instantly from his existing post, but rather, as the church deals with maverick priests, he was found an equally prestigious job elsewhere in the organisation. Looking back now, one of the women concerned was telling me only the other day that it was because there was no sympathetic person to talk to, no acknowledgement of the problem, that the women were easily disbelieved, and several of the men to whom they took their problem thought it was rather amusing. This certainly could not happen today. By the 1980s, there was a general optimism that things were beginning to happen for women in radio and television. I worked then in BBC Current Affairs Television alongside a number of much younger, highly motivated, and enormously talented women producers. Coming together to share frustrations and petty irritations, we identified for ourselves two concepts: what we called the programme wife and what we called the favourite son. The programme wife goes like this. She would be an on-screen partner of the programme's lead presenter, always a man. This obtained both in News at 10 and Newsnight in the 80s. The programme wife, this was our own private designation, I'll have you know. It wasn't at all, the men didn't hear about this at all. The programme wife would never be given the lead interview of the programme, always the later running story. Though evidently capable in her own right, she was rarely presented in that capacity. Her place was literally alongside her partner, but by implication of the programme emphasis, not to be seen as his intellectual equal. Not surprisingly, such programme wives soon grew restless. Among a distinguished line, Jenny Murray moved away swiftly to become the outstanding presenter of Woman's Hour that she is today. Olivia O'Leary stayed briefly, but was soon away to programmes where she carried sole responsibility. In the 1990s, of course, Newsnight has changed its format to a single presenter, and no one doubts that Kirsty Walk clearly holds equal weight with the others. The other concept that television learnt to recognise in those 80s was that of the favoured son. Now, he would arrive on a programme team as part of a new intake, say, the staffing up of a new series. But a similarity of background, schooling, attitude would catch the male editor's attention. Slowly, by small indications, subtle references, identifying moments, The young male newcomer would be groomed along the path taken by the elder. One day, you felt the elder might say, all this will be yours. Thus, the male hierarchies perpetuated themselves, not by overtly disqualifying women or any longer explicitly citing marriage or children as their handicap. It was simply that, perhaps even unwittingly, the hierarchy of promotion fell to favoured sons, the protégés who most nearly echoed the experience and attitude of the other. They may not even have been aware it was happening. The women certainly noticed. In the 1990s, women in media have indeed come a long way. There are a great many radio and television producers and a scattering of outstanding executives. The big broadcasting institutions have, by and large, made pledges of equal opportunity. And if management targets are lagging behind, and they are, I'll come back to that later, that is not where the real and present crisis lies. From women's earliest aspirations, back in those 1930s, they sought an equal place with men in long-term jobs, steadily advancing careers, stable employment with equal and predictable patterns of pay. But just as they began in the 1980s and early 90s to earn a substantial place in such an industry, the industry itself went into convulsive change. That change is rapid, unpredictable, and wide-ranging. The landscape of television and radio is totally different from the times that shaped the hopes and ambitions of women in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. What's more, it is as different for men as for women. In all this turmoil, the new technology, the proliferation of channels and of companies, the fragmentation of the producing base of the industry, there are both opportunities for women and also major problems for them that have not existed before. First, as to jobs. Television and radio are expanding their channels and their outlets, so of course there are more jobs. But companies, and especially the BBC, are streamlining their program operations to skeletal levels. The safe, secure career for men and women is no longer a certainty. Formerly cast iron posts and structures are constantly now under review. Part of this new flexibility is the contract job rather than the staff job. Plenty of today's producers work on 3-monthly contracts. They so no sooner take up such a contract than they have to be searching ahead for the next one. What's more, the job contract will be to a particular program, even a particular item, rather than with a particular company. So there's no incentive for the employing company to map out any career pattern for such employees, to consider their needs, or even allow for personal commitments at all. This falls very heavy on working women with children. Let me give a current example. A well-established and highly respected producer who has worked on current affairs programs for 20 years is a single parent with a child 9 years old. She's a friend of mine. Numerous program assignments have over recent years taken her abroad for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, often to locations of international conflict. And all this she has managed. Her support system is good, she's responsible, she does good programs. But as her child has grown older and become aware of what her mother does and seen footage of wars and conflict on the screen, the child has grown anxious for her mother's safety. So regular and reassuring phone calls, often from dangerous zones, have so far contained that problem. Along comes the next assignment. It's a contract that requires 9 continuous weeks away. It's simply not possible for her to accept that particular undertaking, that particular one. As a freelance contract employee, no other job was on offer, no allowance could be made for her circumstances. Her employers did not make an attempt to allocate her somewhere else. She turned that job down, and she's been unemployed now for several weeks. On the other hand, the short-term contract, the one-off engagement lasting a few months, suits women with children particularly well. They feel they can hold their place in their professional field and yet have substantial blocks of time with their children. It's a juggling act you're familiar with, matching career and children, made all the more difficult, of course, by this country's lamentable attitude to and provision of nursery and childcare facilities. There seems to be no public recognition that half the country's workforce is having to patch and match their domestic arrangements in a way that adds to the tension and guilt of even daring to have a job at all. It's perhaps not surprising that a report, Women in Television, written by Helen Baer of Westminster University, found that women continue to be concentrated at the bottom of the production ladder, in the lower grade support roles, and men still hold the major decision-making positions. Well, that report came out in May. It seems almost ironic that it anticipated the major restructuring of the BBC, which came out in July. In its new form, the BBC's central nexus of its producing and broadcasting operations is entirely male. The two channel controllers are men, so is the World Service Management team. The only two women anywhere near the top echelons, and they're very distinguished women, are the head of personnel and head of planning. A match for anyone, and there are plenty of other women who could be too. This reads badly in the light of the BBC's stated equality targets, which are to have women as 30% of senior management, 40% of senior managers, and 40% of middle management by the year 2000. This is the target as stated in the current year's annual report. Actually, that same aim of 30, 40, 40 was originally targeted for 1996. The BBC, despite its declared equal opportunities policy and its signing up for Opportunity 2000, is clearly falling behind. Press a button and you'll find the same things. You'll find that things are no better at ITV. 10 of the 16 Channel 3 licensees have no female staff at board level, none. 4 of them have no female staff in senior management positions either. Alongside the BBC and ITV giants, the television industry now has some 900 independent programme-making companies. They can vary between small 2 or 3 people setups to larger companies, which means staff of about in the hundreds, 80s, 100s, 120. Now, these are what we call the indies, the independents. They're often new and they're usually youthful, so you might expect them to show new trends and reveal patterns more favourable to women. Depressingly, this is not so. Helen Baer's sample of independents showed that 38% of the women held support jobs as compared with only 6% of the men, while 63% of executive producer jobs and 76% of the jobs of directors were held by men in these independents. Women, however, did better than the national average as independent company directors. You'll realise that the national average for women as company directors is 3%. In the indies, some 35% are company directors. So much then for the jobs. What about pay? There was a time when this was easy to monitor. At the BBC, certain grades carried certain levels of pay, plus designated annual increases, and there was a well-known range of bonuses available for outstanding work. This remains so for BBC staff, but increasingly, as I've explained, the BBC relies on contract employees. The contract culture is killing any hierarchy of wages that once existed for freelancers. People are hired as individuals and can haggle their price up if they're in demand, or be pressured to lower it if they're not. There are scandalous examples of producers exploiting the desperate ambitions of young and eager graduates from media studies, offering them token wages, which of course the young people accept because the reference will look good on their CV. This exploitation hurts men and women alike, of course, and it will take a statutory minimum wage to bring such abuse under control. Meanwhile, there are plenty of high-profile showbiz stories that probably reflect undisclosed truths of lesser figures. Earlier this year, Caroline Quentin and Leslie Ash, the two women stars who are in Men Behaving Badly, discovered that they were each being paid only 2/3 of the fee of the male stars. The men were getting £75,000 for a series, the women were getting £50,000 for a series. These are star people. The two women threatened to strike And there were a new wage agreement was quickly drawn up, but we aren't privy to the statistics, of course. A few weeks later, The Guardian reported that Jenny Hull, co-presenter with Eamon Holmes of the popular programme How Do They Do That, was appalled to discover that Holmes was earning three times as much as she was. This is the report in The Guardian. Now, Holmes earns £500,000 a year. He is a star. So, as the paper commented, a third of that was no mean fee. However, a correction appeared in the next day's Guardian. It stated that Jenny Hull was actually being paid £302 a day for filming, and it said the fee per day paid to women when filming. What do they mean, to women? Where's that phrase come from, and what does it signify? Anyway, given that Eamon Holmes is a star, the disparity was too much for Jenny Hull, who simply walked out of the programme. She was quickly replaced by a presumably more compliant woman. On-screen presenters, newsreaders, compares, people like me, interviewers and so on, are all individually rewarded for their particular talents in the particular place that they are. I can't rival Eamon Holmes, I'm here to assure you. And that's to be expected. But a recent Equiter report into performers in radio and television concluded that on average, female performers are paid 15% less than men per year, despite working 20% more days. Given the vagaries of casting and scripts, these things are hard to quantify. Nonetheless, the Equity report stated that if you have fewer roles, work for more days, get paid less per day for the roles that you do play, you're certainly a woman. Faced with the continuing struggle to sustain their place in the world that is also highly competitive for men, women in television are making decisions about their personal life that men do not make or have to make. Women are deciding either not to have children at all or to have them later in life, in their 30s and 40s. Research conducted by the British Film Institute and published in December 1994 showed that of 391 people in creative television jobs, two-thirds of the men had children, and less than a third of the women. The women who had were less likely to have two or more. And in the over 40 age group, 53% of women had no children, and only 15% of men. According to newspaper interviews, women television executives cited excessive and unpredictable hours, stress, the need to be always available as reasons for making such choices. And there's no doubt, I'm a witness to these matters, that television for the rising generation of young women executives is an all-encompassing way of life. Success calls for sustained and single-minded dedication to a quite remarkable degree. Each woman will feel the call to go home to a sick child, to keep appointments with teachers, to take days off for school holidays, as counting against her when scores for reliability and total commitment, you remember the word from the 1930s memo, total commitment is considered. The best prospect of a sympathetic understanding of such difficulties will be found with a woman boss. Unless women are working for women, they will seek to keep their domestic problems away from the office. I can only imagine that the toll in personal stress and even health can be high. And it's not a scenario that it afflicts even the most progressive of new men. Well, as to me, I did my first broadcast 34 years ago. At the time, I was thrilled, tense, and exhilarated. I did my most recent broadcast, although you saw it on Sunday, I did it 3 weeks ago. I was thrilled, tense, and exhilarated. And I do my next in 4 weeks. I don't think much will have changed. In my 34 years, I've witnessed the steady, though very slow, progress of women towards equality. I have seen strong, talented, and personable young women grow into jobs of influence and authority. I can honestly say it's been one of the greatest rewards of my career. Thank you.
wouldn't have expected less from Joan Bakewell, but that was just a wonderful, inspiring, and also, I have to say, dispiriting account of where we haven't got to, as well as where we have. We'd love to open this up and have a real discussion. Joan is very happy for that to take place. So let's spend 10 minutes batting ideas about. I don't know who'd like to start. Yes, please.
Well, I was running a rival bid to Viva, and I examined their bid and with quite some scrutiny. Obviously, they were rivals. And I think it probably I'm very sorry that it went, because it was a big opportunity. And I regret that all the energy that the young people had, because it's great to see someone starting up a new enterprise. But I actually think their energies were misplaced, and I think they slightly misread the concept that they were trying to put across. However, just to comment on these tables of men sitting at platforms being embarrassed, it's just, being embarrassed won't do, will it? Just too late to be embarrassed.
Would you mind standing up, because they can't hear at the back? Did you hear at the back? Mm.
It's right. Well, if you had, you could, for example, have quotas, but I would be against that. You could have positive discrimination. I think those days have gone, actually. I think it would be invidious. And I also think it would cast a slur on the women who've got there by fighting, applying for the same jobs. Perhaps it's just going to go on being very slow. But my feeling, which is why I paid a tribute to those women of the 1880s, is that it is a remorseless change that cannot be stopped, and it will go on, but it just seems that it's taking so long, and all this lip service that is paid and these figures and statistics that are suggested, one wonders what happens when they get to their planning meetings and completely forget what their intentions are meant to be. I mean, one can only operate as far as one can through voicing one's disapproval and shaming them into it, but they're shameless. I'm not in a position to have any statistics on that, and I'm aware that, of course, there are other broadcasters, because broadcasters are conscious of other programs, and I would not know. I would have thought, for example, I'm simply hazarding, speculating here, but I would expect that in, for example, Scandinavian countries, where, as you probably know, their childcare facilities are absolutely wonderfully in place, and women simply, husbands and wives, have jobs, partners both have jobs. It's never contested as a right of both of them. So I would perhaps think that it was more easy for women to come through at that point. Without having to worry or make these enormously complex arrangements, each individual for her own life. But I could only speculate that is so. In America, I don't know. I mean, what you get, of course, and it applies here too, are the two cultures in which women can go out and have careers because they are employing as their nannies and housekeepers and au pairs what is almost entirely 100% female workforce. So they're doing it on the backs of other women rather than there's any kind of mix. That's something that worries a lot of young women I know.
I wonder if you could comment on what you think the influence of program content has been. I
Well, of course, what we start with the male agenda, don't we? I mean, we've come from a totally male determined set of schedules, and what is interesting is has the infiltration of women made any difference? I would think perhaps that there is a slightly more combative tone to the programmes. If you think of the news agendas and the way they're dealt with, they're done in a very confrontational way, which women can either learn to do and become imitative men. I mean, women are people and men are people, and broadcasters are broadcasters, regardless of gender, and there will be some who are combative and confrontational and others who are more subtle. But on the whole, it would seem to me that on programmes I'm aware of, there is a slightly mellower view of affairs which don't need to win conflict, and that therefore there's a you get further sometimes with a debate. When I've worked with women editors, I've noticed that to be so. There isn't a sense that you've got to score this one and win over the other programmes. So there is a sort of macho impulse in a lot of broadcasters, bracket, one has to say, male and female. It's a very aggressive industry, really. It's built on this combativeness, which, of course, we hear in politics, too. Ours is very combative. So is our law. Our law is very adversarial. And there's a great sense in that's the only way to confront argument, is to say, well, we're for this, and you're for that on the other side. And there is no philosophy that says these are views that can be held in a quorum of people who can exchange views about it. And I would perhaps hazard, though I wouldn't want to be quoted on it absolutely, because there are all sorts of other circumstances that might change it. But on the whole, I would say that women are more inclined to this less confrontational style of discourse. That's hard to say, because there are so many variables in play. Are you part of a department that's going for audiences, light entertainment? You've got to hit program targets these days. You've got to get the ratings. You've got to get the star. That's a different. It depends what your objective is. If your objective is current affairs, I mean, it's impossible to. I mean, it'd be interesting to try and, you know, write a book about it, but it you can't just wing an answer like that.
It would be interesting.
Yes, but you see, the Viva experience proved that women don't listen to women. I mean, they don't want to listen to women. They want to listen to good programmes. I'm with them. I want to listen to good programmes. I don't want to listen to something called women's programmes, defined as such because they're run by women. I just want women to be making good programmes. They're perfectly able to do so, and they are doing so in many places. But you don't, for example, Horizon recently had a woman editor. Did anybody notice? Did anybody say, Horizon's gone very feminine? No. Horizon just was a good programme. That's what women do when they, you know, do the job well. So you don't want them suddenly to turn on the screen and think, oh, there's a feminine influence hit large here. You just think, is this good or not? That'll do. That's the only criteria, in a sense, when you work for on a job, is to do it well. Because the Tories objected. The Tories complained. That's why there was a furore. Brian McWhinney rang to complain. That's why there was the fuss. No. Yes. Absolutely. I mean, there was an unhappy. I mean, first of all, the BBC didn't back her up, which I think was absolutely scandalous. I mean, I think the discreet thing to do, if they felt, I hadn't been into all the private discussion about it, but if they felt that she was over the top, the discreet thing would have been to say, said in public, we back her to the hilt. She is our reporter, and then privately said,
look, we, on the whole, we think that, you know, that's the way to behave. I think to actually create headlines in the Evening Standard saying the BBC apologises for Anna Ford is absolutely scandalous. Just bad management. But the other situation was that she did a very aggressive, to the point, interview with, what was his name, the Chancellor, Kenneth Clark, who incidentally thought it was uproarious, can certainly deal with it. I mean, he has no problem handling aggressive questioning. But parallel with that, at the same in the same programme, apparently, I think it was James Naughtie gave Tony Blair an easy ride. So it did look conspicuously kind to Labour, heavy on the Tories, and we're in a pre-election mode, you know. But the point is, Anna's perfectly able to do that and look after herself. You know, we don't have to be sorry for her. Or she's tough. She's good. We don't know. Male editor and editor, or used to, and there are plenty of women now. The Heart of the Matter team is entirely women, as a matter of fact. So you learn, as it were, to become a broadcaster in the way that Mrs. Thatcher learned to become a politician. You take on the male attributes because that's the way to get to the top. And that maybe, you know, that is what happens to some women, and other women simply don't go that way. But until there's a critical mass of women at management level, we won't know about that. You need a critical mass, otherwise it doesn't amount to anything. I think that's what it is, but we can't know. No.
Two more, and then I think we've got to let Joan go. So, please.
To be resolute, they need to be resolute. They need to be able to sustain rejection. There's a lot of rejection of young people because there's a whole field of pool of young people who would work for free, and you know it's touching, and they're eager. You've got to be flexible, and have initiatives of your own. I mean, it's very. Get free them to think of things on their own. There is enormous systems now for training to do this and training to do that and taking on board the guidelines and following these. I'm for reckless invention, really, particularly when you're young. And also, broadcasting is looking tired these days. One programme looks like another programme. It's only when you get some madness like Chris Evans on The Breakfast Show, which I have to say isn't my taste at all, but you can see that he has just completely turned around and done something new. And it's that that will get young people a place or not, but I mean, they'll stand as much chance by trying to liberate their spirits and, you know, go for something that they feel they believe in. Or they can go, they can learn the routines, they can polish their systems. And, you know, they may still be as much out of work as every other contract worker.
Sheila. Oh, you were waving your hand. In that case, if there's somebody else burning to ask a question, please.
Well, the message is that women get there somehow, but they don't get any help. They don't get help. They don't. They have to make their way. But the good news is that women support women, you know. This is what has happened, I think, very much since the 70s. And since women have talked to women much more and not been all locked off in their homes and with their children. I mean, it's now far... That is, I think, optimistic. I think that what I said, the process of change is implacable. I just believe it. You know, I've seen for 30 years I've watched, and it's getting slowly better. But what I mean, my comments about the 30s are relevant to me because it is very slow. It hasn't gone like that since the 70s. It's gone like that. So, false hopes are mistaken. Yeah.
I'm going to show favouritism and get my youngest son's partner to ask you the last question. Come on.
Yes, I mean, print journalism is a totally different world because it's owned by millionaires, and it's the Independent isn't. I acknowledge that, but I mean, basically, newspapers are owned by rich individuals and deploy their staff and their promotional systems on entirely, and it seems to me, fantastical criteria. I mean, I'm delighted Rosie Boycott's there. It's absolutely terrific. And she's an example of one of, these women who I remember in the sort of 60s and 70s being around, very noisy and strong. That's good. But they don't follow a pattern. They're part of what will one day be this critical mass which will arrive. But we've got Mary here, after all. Mary was a woman, distinguished at The Guardian in the 50s, Mary?
Founder Mary Stott. Please.
Yes. I mean, one of our...
Mary, would you hold on for a second? Because people can't hear you, and you're too important.
Oh, rubbish. a female journalist came up to my daughter at a function and said, "Didn't it upset you that your mother wasn't in when you came home from school and that she worked all the time?" And my daughter looked at her very coldly and said, "No. I was proud of her." And I hope, young ladies, you'll feel the same way your daughters reproach you.
Well, on that note, I'm going to call this evening to a close. I want to thank Joan very much on behalf of us all here. And I think she's raised, actually, some of the most fundamental issues that face us as women, not just in the media, but in all our chosen walks of life. She's also raised the problem of what it should be that we're battling for in terms of change. Do we want more legislation? Can we legislate to deal with these upheavals in the industry that Jones described, the terrible problems of short-term contracts, when we're only just, we hope, getting to grips with the idea of staff jobs that might provide for flexible working, reducing the long hours culture, and so on and so forth. It seems that no sooner have we found some things that seem like solutions to an existing problem then they're all turned over by a huge technical or economic or political new challenge. I think what's very clear is we have to be the inventors also. We have to keep trying to be the futurists, to see what's coming. And if we can't see what's coming, at least to react very, very fast indeed to those political social changes that are in front of us. I was delighted that Joan spoke in favour, albeit kind of in parenthesis, for the minimum wage, because it's one of the things on which Fawcett is doing battle. So I've got two presents for Joan. One is some leaflets, our publications, and you'll see that we're battling on the front of asking women to listen to my vote. Yes, that's right. Helping with the housework you only do if you're male. Why is it the case? Information on women and employment, domestic and home life, poverty and financial security. Please go to our room, pick them up. use this information, argue for these changes. I know that Joan will. And the other thing is something that's sometimes seen as merely feminine. I think both men and women love flowers. Joan, flowers.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.